Hello, Tome listeners. This is your Tome editor, Samuel Dillon. This week, the Tome Show is bringing you special Gen Con 2011 episodes. In order to get them to you faster, these are going to be released unedited. Our sponsor for tonight's episode is Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again. So sit back and relax, and after a message from our sponsor, you'll get to hear tonight's episode. What we have for you tonight is the Gen Con 2011 R&D Seminar.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more, Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
R&D at your service. This is your chance to tell us what you would like to see not only in Dragon and Dungeon Online, but also what you'd like to see in our physical D&D products. I'm Jeremy Crawford. I am the lead rules editor for Dungeons & Dragons. What that means is I oversee the development and editing of Dungeons & Dragons products, both physical products and online products. And Greg, please introduce yourself.
I'm Greg Bilsland. I'm a D&D producer, which means that I manage the products schedule for R&D. I make sure that all the different parts of R&D are communicating and that R&D is communicating with the rest of the company, that our products that have multiple components are made, that assets are being allocated, and so forth.
And the main reason Greg is here today is Greg is one of the magicians who has been responsible, particularly in recent months, at making sure we have all sorts of interesting content in Dragon and Dungeon. All right, so before we open this up to you, because in many ways this is about what you think, I wanted to give you a very short preview of some of the content you are likely to see in Dragon and Dungeon in the next 6 months. I'm doing this, A, to give you a cool sneak peek, but also this is a great chance for us to let you see behind the curtain briefly and for us to tell you that we often commission content for the website as well as for our books 6 months to a year and a half in advance. And oftentimes we'll commission something, particularly for Dragon and Dungeon, and we expect to see it, and then maybe something goes off the rails at some point. What we commissioned is not what we got. And so what you see in the next 6 months might end up being quite different from the little sneak peek you see here. But this is what, as of today, we expect to see in the next 6 months. All right. So first, in September and October, we have a number of cool things on the way. You can expect to see an article on artificers, and the theme for this article is Artificers of Gond. So we'll have a strong Forgotten Realms theme. And the writer of this article I just met last night, actually.
Is it Tim or Doug?
Doug, yeah. Yeah, he was actually in my and Pete's room playtesting a game that I think will be in Sagamore at some point during the convention. In October, we're going to have basically Karatur month, and we're going to give Oriental Adventures some love. And along those lines, we're going to have Oriental character themes. Recently in Dragon, we've released a number of character themes. Those of you who've seen the Dark Sun campaign setting know that that book also has a number of character themes. If any of you are unfamiliar with what a theme is, it's basically a way for you to represent what your character did before he or she became an adventurer. So this might be, escaped slave, Wizard's Apprentice, this sort of thing, and gives you actually some class features as you level up, as well as some optional powers. So these themes will be particularly flavored for Oriental characters. We will also have a ninja-flavored assassin going along with our Karatur theme. And we will also have a build for the Room Priest, which we've been referring to as the Kanji Room Priest. We're imagining this is the Room Priest that, rather than having dwarven runes appearing on his or her weapon or in the air around, this would be a kanji. This is one I'm particularly looking forward to. And then finally, as a part of our Unearthed Arcana series, which is our series of optional rules for the game, we are expecting to see an honor system to tie into the Oriental theme in October.
Okay, Jen and Jeremy.
Uh-huh.
What you may notice about some of these articles is that we are trying to give some love to some of the underutilized or underrepresented classes. We recognize that, particularly for our online consumers, there's a large demand for some of the classes that have not been represented in the core books or were latecomers to the game. And so we are trying to find ways to incorporate that material into the magazines while doing so in a way that they're supported by a solid story, so that we're not just throwing additional mechanics onto a class unless we have a good reason to.
This is a great opportunity for me to, again, in the spirit of letting you look behind the curtain, before I mention, sometimes things go off the rails. There's been a lot of talk online about more love for the Rune Priest. And the poor Rune Priest has had the misfortune of having, if I remember correctly, in the last year and a half, three articles attempt to basically launch and blew up on the launch pad for various reasons. Or made it onto the website, but most of the mechanics that had been designed had to be pulled out because they were not up to snuff. So it's we definitely feel it, and we hear the calls for more love for the Rune Priest, and sometimes our best intentions do not play out as planned. In November and December, we will have content that is going to tie into our print release in this period, Heroes of the Feywild. And so you can expect to see character themes with a fey character. And there are also character themes in the Heroes of the Feywild book. And so these will be additional themes supporting that fey theme. We're also going to focus in on the Moonshades. Those of you who are FR fans know what the Moonshades are. Those of you who aren't FR fans, a quick summary. The Moonshades are a set of islands to the west of Waterdeep that have a strong sort of Celtic feel to them. There are druids, bards, unicorns there, everything you would expect from an area that's meant to evoke the ancient British Isles. And that area of FR is particularly appropriate to tie into our basically Feywild month. We're also expecting to see the classic adventure Baba Yaga's Dancing Hut resurrected at this point for 4th edition. And we will have in our Unearthed Arcana series rules for arcane duels. At the beginning of next year, we will have content that will speak to FR. We're going to have Cormyr character themes, so there'll be things like Purple Dragon Knight, that sort of thing. We also plan to have some channel divinity material that speaks to the gods of Faerun. Then we're going to have elemental character themes, and these will tie into another one of our print releases. book all about elemental magic, which Mike Merles will talk more about on Saturday. And then we'll also have more elemental monsters. And this will be our chance to bring some elemental classics back from the first edition Fiend Folio and the other early monster books. So that's a little sneak peek. And really, from here on out, we want to know what you want to see. Again, not only in Dragon and Dungeon, but also in our print products. So the floor is yours.
One really obvious one that I run into a lot is, you know, adventures that come out in Dungeon oftentimes come with these really nice, well-done cartography maps.
Mm-hmm.
You get a cartographer in there and they do these really cool design maps. But there's no resource for getting those maps and using them on the table. So I have this really cool map that it's like, I want to use this, I want to show this to the players, and I have no way of getting it there without distorting it and making it just not work right.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, what you'd like to see is higher res versions of some of these maps.
Yeah, full size versions of those map resources so that we can use them on the table.
That is something we could easily accomplish. And I know it's been asked before for not only the tagged versions of the maps, but there's a lot of utility for untagged versions.
Yeah, and that's the other problem, is that even if I can find maybe a larger copy res or just pull up the one that's there, it's been tagged with all the geo nodes, so I don't have a way of making it useful.
You don't want to put the map on the table with a catch trap.
Right.
which I have seen before. Yeah. I always love it when the DM blows it up, prints it out, and I say, oh, what's that S on that wall?
Yeah, it's kind of like a print and play version of the module, so that you just take it. You got everything you need to use it, but from an online perspective.
Yeah.
So your request is definitely heard.
Bart, do you want to join us up here?
Bart Carroll, everybody.
This is Bart Carroll, another one of our producers.
Yeah. Continuing on that, it would be interesting if you guys could somehow partner up with a print-on-demand service where you could say, yeah, this is an awesome map, and you've already partnered with someone where we could have a high-resolution poster-sized map printed on demand.
That's something we've recognized as a need and we're exploring.
Yeah, we've actually been exploring that for some time.
Right. And for those of us that are like uber digital nerds that have the overhead projector projecting down on their whiteboard, having those assets available, again, without the marks.
Those are things that I would like us to do as well. I know one of the other requests for Dungeon Adventures in particular is a better way for Dungeon Masters to find adventures for the right level. It can be a bit of a challenge to sort through all the adventures we have, and sort of a better categorization of them as well is something we'd also like to accomplish.
A nice database.
I have a few different things. I don't know if the Morden Canons book is going to address this or not, but going back through the magic items that were published previously and doing a better job of pulling out some that should be common items, some that should be rare items. I don't know if that's something you'd ever let a freelancer do or if that has to come from R&D, but it's something I've done for my group because it wasn't there.
The wheels are turning, I'll say that.
Okay.
Yeah. Because we know definitely that the rarity system needs to be applied more universally. Because there are absolutely items right now that in the compendium are tagged as uncommon, which are functionally common.
Mm-hmm.
The Mordenkainen's Magnificent Emporium will provide rarity for some items that are already in print, but many of the items in that book are new.
Right.
That book provides good benchmarks, though, for figuring out rarity for other things that are in print. Keep your fingers crossed. Hopefully, the rarity tagging on everything else will be done by the time the book comes out. I'm not making any promises. We would love it if the two things coincided.
Just out of curiosity, out of the Dungeon Masters in the room, how many people have been using magic item rarity in their game as a way to allocate items? Okay, so a significant amount.
We're going to, but we haven't started that campaign.
But I would if it was a little bit more specified.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And those of you who are using it, have you found it useful?
Sure, yes.
And in your games, I know this is really about us listening to your questions, but we can also really you guys. In your games, before the rarity system came out, did you leave the acquisition of magic items in the hands of the players, or was it always in the hands of the DM, or was it a hybrid?
We used to, we noticed pretty quickly that the first and second, sixth and seventh, and so on, the first couple of the range of five was always the fairly common ones, or low-powered ones. And so in our group, I allowed the characters to pick whatever they wanted that had to be either first, second, sixth, or seventh, and so on. And then if they wanted the fourth, fifth, or the higher tier within the section, they had to find it.
We implemented the wish lists pretty close to as written. It worked very well. It became, and every five or six levels, kind of a big chore for me as the DM to go through and make the decisions. But it worked very well and gave them a lot of control over what they got without, with still surprises. So I think it worked very well.
I let them buy items at certain level ranges, depending on where they went, and that was a huge mistake.
Jeff?
I implemented the wish list system and then made the decision that I'm not giving them anything on the wish list. But it was a great way for me to get feedback from my character about
what items not to give them.
I'm not giving him that item, but I know that he wants to be a good archer, and then I would pick out items that I thought would work well for the characters without actually giving them specifically what they asked for. And then if they want to get that thing, they can go out shopping on it with their cash or whatever.
Sure.
So it's more of a Shattered Dreams list.
That's fantastic. That's the kind of DM.
I do something in my home campaign, I don't give them the option to buy magic items at all. They're just presented. I give them what I think they're going to need for the future. They're not, they're not going through what I don't have power players, so I just give them what I think they're going to need. I don't give them any gold.
The rarity system was good for two things. One, when I had players making new characters, I pretty much told them that they would just pick from common items, which was great for people because it was a relatively short list by comparison.
Yeah.
I never really did the wish list thing. A lot of my players are pretty old school, so we all just kind of believe that acquiring treasure is a lot of the wonder of the game, and it's wonderful to not be able to know what you're going to get and be able to make use of random items. So it got to the point where I was pretty much saying, telling the compendium, give me all of the seventh level items. No, there's 167 of them, so I will roll a D167. So essentially doing my own, random generation. I think would be great if there was a system for it, whatever it is, because that was something that I kind of miss.
How many of those random items are your players keeping versus melting right down into residuum?
Well, when they purchase, I'm only letting them purchase commons anyway. So okay. When they get the uncommons, they're special and interesting, and it's amazing the utility that they have found out.
Mm-hmm.
So no, they haven't melted them down, but then they don't have the attitude that magic items are things I should be able to buy
right.
And get exactly what I want. They've not had that attitude since they're from earlier editions of the game I played. So that was kind of nice to have the rarity system because it kept some of the purchasing under control, but then let me have this wondrous things at them.
My group is probably not normal. I'm the only one that puts a lot of time into the game. Even the guy I've been playing with since 1980, he doesn't put as much time into it. And they trust that I'm going to give them something that's useful for one of the characters at some point. They really don't bother having to keep track of gold. One person writes it down, but they never go out and buy magic items because whenever they've tried, they don't find anything useful. They just trust that I'm going to give them something that works for their characters.
Go ahead.
I've tried the wish list at the beginning, but I soon realized that it was really difficult to pick some of the items they wanted to fit into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
It just wouldn't make sense for kobolds to carry around magic armor, heavy magic armor and things like that. So I just used that as a basis for the kind of items that they would like and worked around it gave themselves the option of disenchanting items first chance they got, so they can ultimately get whatever they want.
While we're on the topic of magic items, one of the series that we do on DDI is Bazaar of the Bazaar, and so if there's any magic items you'd like to see, let me know, because we're planning out our content for next year, and we can set up some articles to try and deliver on those.
I want there to be a fantastic, easily way that I can go into Character Builder and eliminate all of those items. Because like right now, there's no way for me to...
Sort by source.
Well, yeah, sort by source is fine, but then...
Right, the old one had the checkbox.
Eliminate by source.
Yeah, I want a checkbox where I can say...
No, don't use...
Don't kill me.
No offense. I've always gotten the sense... I've always gotten the sense that, yes, the DDI content is playtested, but perhaps not as rigorously as the core book's material. Because I have too many optimizers in my campaign. And when they have 1,001 options, they'll be on the forums and finding... the best options, and they'll find the best combinations, and they'll ask for something, and it'll appear mundane, and then I have to figure out how many rust monsters I need to put in one room at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. And you talk about the sort of the difference in quality assurance.
Sure.
That's something we've talked about in the podcast, that we have actually changed in the past 6 months a lot of our processes, particularly related to the magazines. I still call them magazines, even though they're not.
Easy.
And so that is something that we have been addressing head-on, of making it so that when you look at something presented in Dragon, it will have the same quality as something you'd see in one of our books. Because, frankly, earlier in the edition, that was not the case. And it's obvious. I mean, anyone who knows the game well, you can look at something from one of our books and compare it to something that was released in the magazine, and often there's a disconnect.
Right. And I don't think you'll ever go back and errata magazines.
Actually, we have started that process.
We've been going through issue by issue, working backwards, working forward, to... address many of those problems, addressing not only things that are strictly errata, typos, but also doing a rules review of some of the material.
Yeah.
And Jeremy's team has been responsible for that.
That said, there are going to be things that will simply remain wonky, because we are in a strange position with the game, in that it is simultaneously a tabletop game, as it always has been, but for many people it also is partially a digital game. And so our players, who primarily see the game through the lens of the Character Builder and the online compendium, many of them would love to see us just revise and errata everything all the time. You know, and frequently we get feedback of, why don't you just change this thing? This balancing act that we're constantly trying to do is, well, let's rein in those things that might be harming the play experience for the majority of our groups, while acknowledging that at the end of the day, it is still a tabletop game, and in many groups, there are people who never look at our website. Like, to them, the game is the game they got in their book. And so we always have to stay our hand if we start getting tempted to change something so drastically that the play experience in one group would be wildly different from the play experience in another. Where, you know, a person who played in group A suddenly goes to group B and they're using a version of a spell or something else and they're like, I don't even recognize that thing anymore. What happened? Well, you didn't see, you know, rules update 97 that just came out. And so again, it's a balancing act. And sometimes we slip up a little bit on the trapeze wire, and other times I think we hit the balance dead on.
Just two things. One related to that. Is there a way, or will there be a way, to filter out older Dragon content that was done before you started doing the more rigorous playtesting from the new stuff in the compendium and in the Character Builder?
If we if we are able to restore the ability to turn sources on or off, it would just be universal. I mean, we wouldn't single out any particular product.
So you can say, like, here's a dateline. Because I think, like, the design of everything got a lot better after a certain date.
Hmm.
And then we could just say, like, everything below that date,
We could never do that either, because there are too many things before that date, and many of us would argue about when that date is. Too many things before that date that are the foundation for many of the things that came after.
What about a Magic the Gathering style restricted and banned list? Like, you could play full bore with everything. You can play, the limited version where these wonky items have been removed. You know,
Mike, I think you're just gonna have to be making the lists.
Yeah. They don't get items anymore.
It is something that, sort of just as an academic topic, we have discussed before of, could we just ban things the way Magic does? At the end of the day, though, it's Dungeons & Dragons. And in Dungeons & Dragons, there is a DM, and there are players who have a social contract. And outside of organized play, where people do have to follow sort of, the letter of the law, we expect that groups will, through mutual understanding and discussion, weed out the things that are somehow inhibiting their play experience. And so we expect that if a group thinks something should be banned, we expect and hope that that group is banning it. Because the last thing we want any D&D group to do is use something that is somehow undermining their play experience. D&D, in all of its forms, is really a toolbox that we hand over to each group and say, create magic with this. And create the magic you want to create with this.
So, I've noticed that in a lot of the recent publications, there's a hardcore lack of rituals. What's the story of rituals?
Rituals sort of have been in hibernation, haven't they?
Yeah.
There's got to be a story there.
We did recently publish our index to rituals.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I would say? I'd say if people want to see more rituals, please pitch them the next time we ask for magazine pitches, which is in October.
And just out of curiosity, by just raising your hand, who would want to see more rituals in the magazines?
And how many of your groups use rituals on a regular basis?
Multiple times per session.
And could you go around real quick, those of you who raised your hands, and tell us, just pick one ritual that you think you see used more often than any other in your group. And just let's start on this side and go across. And Greg, can you write these down?
Teleportation circle.
Tensor's list or Tensor's disc? Tensor's grocery list?
Tensor's holding goods.
Conrad Sigor.
Mm-hmm.
Your recipes. Soul's bowl.
This one's going to sound what was it? Create campsite.
Yes.
Yeah.
Players love that one.
Yeah, from Player's Handbook 2.
We use a lot of divination. Consult oracles.
Uh-huh.
What was the one that was back there?
That's a good question.
Oh, great. Yeah. Actually, I was about to say Hero's Feast, but he spoke up. I use all of those all the time, and there are a few others that I'm not remembering right now. They just use them all the time. Comrade Sucker on my online game, almost every week. The teleportation circles, multiple times per session.
Mm-hmm.
Create a campsite if they're trying to be stealthy in their movements, all the time.
You want more?
No, that's great.
All right, so we don't. That ace doesn't get to talk about rituals anymore at all.
So what? What new rituals would you like to see? What are there some magical effects that you feel are lacking in the ritual system?
Ooh,
yes, sir. Trevor, this is their seminar. We're here to see what they want.
Don't actually listen to me.
I can wait till Saturday until we do our seminar and just talk about rituals the whole time. What I created for my players, because it was kind of lacking, is the idea of doing temporary enchantments to weapons. So, like, they're going up against a bunch of frost giants. You know, I gave them a way to do kind of a ritual that gave them for a day. You know, you can make all your weapons flame weapons and gave them, you know, plus, you know, 4 damage against, you know, ice creatures and stuff. And just rituals that would do temporary enhancements to, like, weapons and gear and armor and that kind of stuff would be really cool. I mean, you know, it wouldn't have to be something that would be like, well, now your armor's always +1 or +2. It's just like, for today, you get this. That would be cool.
Yeah. Any others?
There are some in the Revenge of the Iron Lich Delve. Have you seen that? It's one of the 4th core initiative things, like freelance writer, but kind of the general idea of Gygax's old Tomb of Horror style delving, and wrote this whole 4th edition module out of it. He wrote some custom martial practices and rituals for that specific to the Delve, but they provided specific information for the Delve that they were interesting from a flavor perspective, and that they gave the players a way to kind of directly interface with the world around them specific to that Delve and that campaign.
Yeah.
So stuff like that, where it's kind of contextual, like you can, you know, learn a ritual that lets you speak with the spirits of Neverwinter or whatever, and that's very specific to that sort of thing. I think it's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
The martial practices, it looks like they were touched on once and never come back to. I would love to see some martial practices for, like, the Thief of the Rogue, like, actually setting traps. You know, let's set up an ambush here, I'm going to perform a martial practice to get a jump on the enemy as they're coming in, or something like that.
That's a good idea.
For rituals, one thing I really like to do is, like, city building in my campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I have some really modeling, but there could be, like, infrastructure rituals, like creating walls and roads. It sounds kind of boring.
No, it'd be quite cool. Especially really high-level rituals.
Yeah.
Call up a building.
Yeah. One of the things that I've done is I'll take, like, Sudoku puzzles and things like that and place it all with runes and turn that into a magic circle ritual.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of taking the idea of rituals and turning it into some sort of mini-game, I think, would bring in my more power gaming players into the idea, because right now they just don't care. You know, if it's not combat, then they hand wave and go get a drink while I talk about how they teleport from place to place.
Yeah, but that's really interesting. A puzzle instead of a money cost at low levels might make them.
It's what brings them to them from a technical point of view. You know, they're interested in solving that rather than just rolling a die and seeing if they hit a DC.
So, something I've been doing in my home campaign is letting the characters essentially perform ad hoc rituals, and I use the skill challenge mechanics for them to pull it off. And so rather than spending money, they make a series of checks. And when... Greg, were you at the session?
No.
Oh, you missed it. Yeah. There was this ritual where the characters were attempting to fool the spirit of this evil high priest to come back to this body that he had just been expelled from. And they were basically using the life force of one of the characters as the bait. And so that character kept spending healing surges combined with these checks. They, through a series of him making endurance checks and others making religion and arcana checks, they managed to lure this spirit back to the body. Then they started this second ad hoc ritual using the skill challenge rules to try to then expel the spirit into the realm of the dead, a.k.a. the Shadowfell. Because this was this high priest who, every time he died, his spirit could leap into somebody else's body. And the players loved it. And I do it because it's a much more dynamic way of engaging with the ritual concept of you have this series of checks. It makes it easier for me as the DM to model partial success. Because, you know, a lot of things in the game are sort of all or nothing. You did it or you didn't. And I like sometimes the narrative complication of, well, you kind of did it. And because you only made it halfway there, all sorts of interesting complications just got unleashed on the campaign.
That's actually very similar to what they did with this last season of Encounters. Like, that was the finale, mm-hmm. is they did that ritual in the crypt where they were trying to get the Fontarin's soul back into his body.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be a good model for doing rituals like that if anyone has a hold of that much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would also say that the skill challenge mechanics are a really good foundation for DMs to just make up mini games on the fly. If you just want a framework for, well, the characters are going to attempt X, so now they're going to do this sequence of Y and Z. And the skill challenge framework provides a way to quickly model that in the game.
Do you think maybe there would be a possibility of having some published stuff on the website kind of giving examples of that and giving people kind of things that they would... Because, I mean, some people...
More skill challenge examples?
Well, I mean, taking skill challenges and putting them into things like rituals and mm-hmm. practice and kind of showing the... You know, people just need more... When's the DMG3 going to come out?
It's not currently on the schedule.
People just need it, you know, some people need examples. They need to constantly be shown, like, this is how it could work. You know, what partial success, like you said, what partial success looks like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does continuing the story on when they fail look like? Because, you know, they still, if it's like a ritual or martial practice, they've invested something in it already,
right.
So they don't want to just see it go down the drain. And so kind of giving these published examples of, this is your investment and your effort still paid off in this way, or, and I think people would like to see that, or at least I would like to see that.
I would like to see it. Do you have skill challenge examples on the list?
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Speaking of skill challenges, I was looking over the Redbox DM book last night, and you do a skill challenge in there with the white dragon trying to convince him not to kill you. And the write-up in there is correct. Every place else I see skill challenges, it's terrible because Arcana of 18 or better, this happens. Well, I have 5 people making Arcana checks. Okay, that happened again. Okay, that happened again. But in there, you said, this is what they could do. These are possible skills they could use. This is the target DC. And here's a bunch of different things that could happen in these different skill sets. I did D&D Encounters, and there was a skill challenge, save the people, the Shadowfell, of DuPont, Azure, and the Shadowfell. It was very arbitrary. Save them. My player's like, I don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I spun it. It's like, okay, well, you come across a group of, you know, scared children, and you have to get them back home, or, you know, someone is being attacked by a shadow beast, and you have to scare them off to kind of drive that. But the way they're written up, it's very specific. If they roll a 12 or better on endurance, then this happened.
Mm-hmm.
Just the way the skill channels are presented, I think, is like, fluid and less mechanical.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also in the rules compendium that came out at the same time as Heroes of the Fallen Lands, we presented the skill challenge rules in a new way and introduced the concept of advantages, and the red box skill challenge had the advantage of using that new material. So yeah, a lot of our earlier skill challenges have a slightly different approach.
I've taken a little bit of the opposite approach, which is, again, my group is very mechanically focused and they're just in that stuff. So I started writing the skill challenges up in a sheet that described all the different possible skills and what they would do and what the DCs were and successes and failures, and threw it on the table. And they would work around and try to say, okay, well, this one's really hard, so who's going to assist me on this? And they worked it out among themselves, and they actually enjoy that far more than the kind of back and forth skill challenge. So for them, it was like, normally, they just felt like they were rolling a DC, and they'd have to come up with some BS about why they were using their maxed out skill. Like, I'm going to intimidate somebody by bench pressing something.
Right.
It worked a lot better when they said, "Oh, these DCs aren't necessarily that hard, and I can use one of my off skills."
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
Making skill challenges more gamey is something that I know would bring my group back into a lot more.
It's a tough failure when they can't bench press.
Yeah, he fails,
and they're just sitting there with a bar on himself.
That's something we have to see in the community in the forums a lot too, is you'll have people who want more support for skill challenges, but then what they're actually asking for are very divergent things. Like,
yeah.
people's like, I just want more examples of straight-up skill challenges.
Right.
But people are like, I want more ways to integrate role-playing into my skill challenges, right? I want, you know, I want it to feel more like seamless storytelling and less like
mm-hmm.
Oh, like, everybody get out of the game, start rolling dice,
and
then get back in the game.
And
yeah,
that,
so what's the DMG3?
That... And Trevor, that speaks to one of the other balancing acts that we are constantly having to do. You know, I mentioned before that balancing act between like the tabletop experience and our digital offerings. There is also, and this has been true in every edition of D&D, the balancing act of presenting the material that speaks to two very different kinds of groups, and then there are many groups sort of in the spectrum in between, but. There are D&D groups that are extremely gamist. I mean, they totally groove on the die rolling, the number crunching, optimizing their characters, and that is and always has been a very legitimate way to engage with Dungeons & Dragons. On the other end of the spectrum, sort of at the most hardcore, we have groups that are pretty much engaged in theater of the mind. It's all about the storytelling, the characterization, coming up with intricate plots and mythologies. And I think many of our groups tend to cluster somewhere in between those two extremes, you know, where there is a mix of storytelling, characterization, and that heavy game experience. But as you know, Trevor, if you go on any message board about D&D, you'll have people clamoring for X or Y and insisting that one of them is what D&D must have, and often what they want is directly in opposition. But in our minds, that's a part of the magic of D&D, is that somehow this game, through all of its years, has managed to encompass within it this broad spectrum of tastes and this broad spectrum of gameplay experiences. And again, it's just the challenge then is presenting material that appeals to people all across that spectrum.
But I will say, and I think you're exactly right, people have asked for examples of skill challenges.
Yes.
And you can do multiple examples that meet both of those player sets.
Yeah.
The DMG3, maybe that's something that lives online. I mean, there's no reason why those types of articles can't be part of, you know, online content.
Let me also point something else out. My friend Victor Morales always says the DMG and the DMG2 are two of the best books ever written that no one's ever read.
Mm.
A lot of what ails you is already written.
Yeah.
It's already in there.
Yeah.
People are just not taking the time to read it. So,
yeah.
You know, just read those books. They're great books.
And yeah, they are great books. Just tons of great advice. And I'm just saying this in case any of you haven't read either of those books. There is advice, particularly in DMG1, that is relevant no matter what edition of D&D you're playing. I mean, it to me is one of the best presentations about not only DMing but just game mastering, regardless of system.
There were a couple of articles that came out just recently that I absolutely was thrilled to see: the archery contest, the jousting.
Mm-hmm.
I would actually love to see more articles that support that sort of thing, of the characters end up at a festival and have to impress people, or...
Yeah, that was definitely the theme for that one. The wrestling article as well.
The wrestling
yeah.
one, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another really good way to get that skill activity in there.
Yeah.
Any specific... Anyone specifically that you want to see? That's okay. We can
yeah.
figure out
I
it.
Can,
I just
can,
I just
yeah. We don't.
Later.
We'll give you our email address at the end. So feel free to flood us with.
Is there a good? I mean, one of the things I've always had a problem with the Dragon and Dungeon magazines is there's just so much content.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a database besides like the compendium where you can peruse articles, synopses, and then go off to the full article? And,
Does the index have descriptions? There's a couple tips that I have for finding what I want. One is just to go onto Google, do a site search, wizards.com/D&D, and then search for what you want, and you'll get anything that sort of related to that. And then you search for Paylor, and you'll see most of the Paylor articles. You can also search in the archives, and you can sort it by type of article. That's a little more challenging because some things like features encompass a broad spectrum of articles. We do have one place where there's short descriptions of articles, but doesn't that...
No, but your question and your answer points to a fundamental problem, I think, of the website, is that there is a lot of content and it's very hard to find. And once it rolls off the front page or the headlines, then how do you know what that content is and to even know to go find it? I don't have a great answer except that that's a problem we recognize and we would like to address with the website
more
content.
Databases. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like the compendium. It's awesome. It's useful. It's not optimized for the iPad, but hey. and having those kind of things in there and referencing the articles that they came from. Mm-hmm. So the more and more you can do on databases,
that's a DBA. Definitely feedback we can give. I'm not sure if it's something we ever point out at Gen Con, but when it comes to our digital offerings, we have a lot of feedback ourselves, and we always bring your feedback. But to be clear, our department actually is not responsible for any of them.
Yeah.
And so we...
They don't come to Gen Con.
The tools. We do bring the feedback for the tools. For the website, absolutely.
Yeah, we have a... R&D, in fact, has a list of requests that we give to our DDI studio We try to listen to you and tell them what we think that the fans want, and then they have a long list of things, and we help them determine what the priorities are.
Our lists have many of the exact same things on them.
So what's the hang-up? that's a serious
question. It's always a question of resources.
Resources, yeah.
Just time, people.
Right.
I mean, and sometimes it's a decision between balancing whether we want skill challenges in the compendium or artifacts in the compendium or item sets in the compendium. There's a lot of different things that we know people want, and trying to figure out what we can accomplish each month or each update is something that we work with the studio on.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. And we make recommendations, but again, at the end of the day, it's not our call.
Sure. Well, it'd be interesting to have one of the studio, capital T, capital S, come to Gen Con and get some of this feedback directly, I guess.
We do pass it on.
Could you maybe add keywords to the articles? Mm-hmm. So you could search the articles by keywords like, what's an article on fire creatures? And then you search by the word fire on the article instead of just the companion.
Yeah, and this, again, sort of a sad answer, but our search has been lacking on the website. They've upgraded it recently, but then that means, so now we have the opportunity to make better use of those keywords. So now we have to make better use of those keywords and do exactly that.
Part thing all the time going through a tag.
Well, fortunately, we have a new web producer, and all that's going to now be Bart's job.
I'm moving from content to sort of the website itself. So again, what do you want to see? I'm very interested in, as well as the website. I think there are some fundamental issues I would like to address with the website. I think the homepage has issues.
Is that pop-up still there?
The interstitial should be only there the first time you go to the website, unless you've got your cookies disabled.
Your cookies are better than you. Are you guys going to start at any point recompiling the issues? Because I would argue it's not really Dragon Magazine anymore. It's just a bunch of articles. Mm-hmm. I mean, they haven't had Dragon in how many months now? It's just article after article. But it used to be end of the month comes, here's everything we did in the month. Because if I'm gone for a week, I might not see that article.
Mm-hmm.
And then as far as I'm concerned, it never existed.
Mm-hmm.
It was nice to have, okay, this was Dragon 381 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Here's everything we did in the month.
So it sounds like there's two desires for the compilation. Number one, so that it feels more like Dragon Magazine. And number two, because content rolls off the site so quickly,
right.
If it's not compiled, you tend to miss content.
And we're looking at solutions to both of those.
Yeah.
I have a follow-up on that, though. Would it be useful to you if it was just at least you could see them in chunks? I
Well, you're not talking about taking all these PDFs and wrapping them into one giant PDF again, are you?
I like that, because honestly, like, I like the ability to download it all, and then if I'm just looking at it, you know, offline, then I've got the whole thing. I can read it. But I have the ability of 100 different things. I want to download one thing.
Right.
You know, I don't
do it both ways then, is my request.
I'm with you on that. I also visit the website very infrequently.
Mm-hmm.
And I sometimes catch people on Twitter saying, this is a great article. I said, I completely missed it.
Mm-hmm.
So the download would actually be helpful to me.
And the ones that are not currently being set up as PDFs,
mm-hmm.
If it has useful information in it, but it's just being put out there as a web page,
mm-hmm.
really slows down my capturing it and putting it where I'll be able to find it again.
Yeah.
So,
in fact, just this month we produced the editorial as a PDF to try to
mm-hmm.
help
that. Okay.
Just out of curiosity, how are people finding what content is coming? Are you looking at the editorial calendar? Are you looking at the Dragon Dungeon TOC pages? Are you just catching them on the front page?
RSS.
Catch as catch can?
RSS feed.
RSS feeds?
Yeah. I hear a lot of RSS feeds from people. It's an easy way to keep track of everything.
Yeah. I guess Twitter feed to notify someone.
Who runs that, by the way?
It's
not us. I was happy when I saw it, but someone out, a fan, it's cool, started up an RSS feed, I'm sorry, a Twitter channel that just talks about, this article came out.
So, Trevor, that I run 4E blogs, which gathers all the 4E blog stuff, but the RSS feed for Wizards was the only one that didn't have pub dates. So I had to make a Twitter feed so I could generate an RSS feed. The funny thing is they've now fixed it. So now I don't need it anymore, but a lot of people subscribe to it, so it's like,
cool.
I don't even know the password to it anymore. So. it's just going to live on.
It's going to keep going forever.
You send that season to see what I can do.
No.
Yes, sir.
I actually have two questions. One is kind of related to that. Recently there was an article, there was a posting questioning whether Dragon and Dungeon needed being separate.
Yeah, that was Steve Winter's latest editorial, sort of asking that question.
And I was wondering if you gotten any feedback, is there any plans, or basically where does that stand? If you just don't
feedback
know
so far is mostly, it looks like, keep it separate, right?
Well, I think it's mostly mixed all over the board, which was interesting unto itself, and I think that's how Steve had actually premised his editorial, saying this has been sort of a question that's come up again and again and again for us. Is there a decision we want to make? Is there a decision we have to make? And we sort of presented it out to the readers, and it's been mixed.
Yeah.
It has been mixed.
We posed that question without really much of a stake in the argument. We wanted to see what people would say. We didn't have any plans to go one way or the other, and I was actually surprised by the number of people who wanted it to revert back to Dungeon having only adventures and Dragon having everything else, because we've been operating in 4th edition with the Dungeon has all of the DM stuff and Dragon has all of the player stuff, and you know, I think it's a very divisive issue, but it was interesting to see the number of people who wanted the more traditional separation.
It's interesting, and going back to what you were saying about the compilations as well, there sort of has been an identity to Dragon and Dungeon magazine. And at the same time, it's a different era of web publishing where we don't necessarily have to compile things that way, and so I think we're sort of forging ahead and figuring out what's working for us and what's not.
Has there been any talk about either going from a landscape to portrait? Because you know, on my iPad, you know, you're on your iPad, I like a portrait view
mm-hmm.
when you're reading a magazine or things like that, you're reading a book, and so. It's like, oh, I got to read this way,
mm-hmm.
and so I didn't know if there was like, you know, talks or options to, you know, have that.
It's good bit of feedback.
Because no. anytime you make the content, where I can be on my iPad and go do everything from that
mm-hmm.
to get to the content, that's gonna be that delivery system's gonna be way better.
Yeah.
So.
Than,
portrait
going to my computer, going to my browser, downloading the PDF, and then going and copying that PDF over to my iPad. Or even downloading it from the iPad, but still the website is kind of wonky.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, it doesn't really support the Safari browser so well. So.
I've had some discussions with one of our typesetters, the people who put the text files into the
mm-hmm.
PDFs, about various integration with the iPad, but we're still just in sort of the initial exploration of that.
You have like an iPad app that you can say, here, just like Marvel's doing it and DC's doing it, like here's the delivery mechanism for the electronic content, where you can have the iPad app and you can, you know, I want to see this Dragon magazine. You click on it, and it maybe is real-time compilation of all the articles, or you have one that's there, but maybe I want to compile these articles into one, you know, bundle for me, because I've personalized, you know, bundling of articles, however I group them, and if you tag them, certain way I can search for it. I say, okay, well, that's what I need for this, and I've got it, and it's right there, and I can reference it during the game, either as a player or as a demon, and it's right there.
I think that's a great idea.
I want that app, too.
Yeah, I would want that.
Have it half right.
Yeah.
It does, actually. It's pretty bright.
The next version, this is like another app, the next version of iOS 5 has a newsstand feature,
right.
So it can actually download all these articles in the background, so I've been playing around and using Greg and Dungeon as my sample content.
Oh, that's cool.
And bringing down the PDFs. The editorials were giving me, because I can't get those if they're in HTML, right. Now that they're, I can pull those down, but it would really require like one XML or database file on your guys' end, and it could just automatically build. But then you could take it yourself, or we could put tags in the file or something, but I'll talk to you.
And that's the way that people consume content is one area where it's nice actually to have the fans working on easier ways to consume our content, because we know that sometimes it's difficult for us to get resources allocated to creating those type of applications to consume the content.
We can't publish them because we'll get in trouble. So
right.
The stuff I write, I just write and use myself because getting something.
Good for you, but it'd be great for us.
Right, you know, that's what I'm saying. Like getting something official out there would be.
Or license it so that he can do it legally.
Yeah.
An API or something.
We produce a lot of content online. I think there's a lot of ways we can deliver it a lot better to you.
Mm-hmm. Recently in your Rule of Three, you said that you didn't have any planned Gamma World content. Now, is that simply because it's just not on the schedule, or there's been some talk that you're not supporting Gamma World at all?
If we say we don't have anything planned, it just means it's not on the schedule right now.
But you have no ideas of any planned future content.
If we did, I couldn't tell you. Basically, we can only talk about the things that are on our public schedule. But I'm happy you asked that, because sometimes people mistake our saying we don't have plans to do X as saying X is dead. We're never going to do it again. This just means we're not doing it now.
I do have a few other things that are on my list of content that's missing from the game still.
Please, keep going.
I'm hoping the Feywild book fixes this one, but some of the traditional Fey, Greys, Sylphs, the pretty Fey, have never shown up in this edition.
Mm.
And a lot of normal animals, likewise. that, you know, you have to go out and hunt for something that's completely different, but that you can sort of twist back to be a normal critter.
I hate to break it to you, but Heroes of the Feywild book is a player book.
Okay, so it's not going to fix
it. It does have some setting material, but it doesn't have monsters.
Monsters. Okay,
yeah.
Then I definitely.
But that's really good feedback for us to have, because it may not be too late for us to get that content scheduled around the same time.
Related to Beastie.
I'd sort of like to second that, I think, because like the Shadowfell have the two Shadowfell books, right? Yeah, and the Feywild book is sort of late in the year, so I'd sort of been hoping that at the beginning of next year there would be a Feywild setting book.
Mm-hmm. jumping to a different thing, War Priest domains, that if you want to be a priest of particular gods, there isn't one that looks right. And looking at just the roster of standard gods and seeing, can we make something for luck? Can we?
And we know there's some in the Neverwinter book.
Yes.
Which we haven't seen.
Yeah, the Neverwinter book has War Priest domains that are god-specific rather than sort of broader concept-oriented.
Okay, but they still might plug some of those ones. And when we were talking about magic items earlier, items to support some of the newer classes or builds, that all of the assassin-specific stuff out there talks about shrouds. The warlock stuff isn't for the hexblade; it's for people that
use curses.
So so some of the, well, the feed and the item support for these newer guys.
Does Morning Cadence have many items that are sort of build neutral?
Yeah, that book has items that are meant to appeal to as many classes as possible.
Okay.
And more and more, that has become our approach, particularly as the family of classes has become larger and larger and more diverse. We have shifted our focus whenever possible toward creating things that will appeal to as many of those characters as possible rather than things that drill down. That said, Dragon is a great place to provide things that are tailored for particular classes.
And like the Black Zealot Assassin article we just put out had some items specifically tailored for that assassin. And I think that's where you'll probably see those specific items.
Okay. Do you have more on your list?
No, that's it.
Oh, okay.
That's kind of a great segue to the question I wanted to ask was about Dragon Magazine, because you had made a comment earlier about basically submitting, you know, rituals and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that. And I know every once in a while you guys throw out like an article like this, how to get published or, you know, what really helps. But is there kind of specific things that you guys look for those of us out who are wanting to submit stuff? Is there specific things that you kind of look at that you're looking for to fill gaps, or just kind of we should come up with a list and
We're looking for support for specific types of characters, like I mentioned. So, you know, the game has many sort of corner case builds. You know, like the Swarm Druid is a great example from Primal Power. It's sort of not the middle of the fairway druid. It's kind of a left of center or right of center, depending on which way you're facing. And there's not a whole lot tailored specifically for the Swarm Druid. So someone might want to submit something for that type of druid. There is not a whole lot for like the Star Pact Hexblade, particularly because the Star Pact Hexblade was introduced in Dragon, and so could probably use maybe some items that speak particularly to that type of hexblade. Even better, though, for us, when we're looking at content, is something that might be targeted toward the Swarm Druid or the Star Pact Hexblade that would also be useful for somebody else. Because, again, the edition has so many classes, and many of those classes have multiple builds with very specific needs. I keep coming back to the theme of balancing acts. So if you can come up with something that's really flavorful, that maybe speaks to a particular target in the edition, but maybe has sort of a splash effect when it hits the target so that other people can dip into that pool, that's all the better. Going back to that assassin article, it's a great example of what I'm talking about. A lot of it focused on providing some additional options to the original Shroud Assassin. But then if you take a look at the feats in that article, many of them were for assassins of all types. So if you're playing an executioner assassin, designed by Rodney Thompson at the back of the room, you could take those feats as well. So that's what I'm talking about. The article was aiming at a particular target, but had a splash effect.
And Thaddeus, to add to what Jeremy's saying, we do go out of our way to solicit some specific content where we identify some of those holes, but we're always looking for really compelling stories and things that we think will appeal to a broad number of players. And so it's kind of, we want Dragon to be made up of partially stuff that the content that Wizards is determining, but also what you guys are telling us that you want. And I think that will satisfy everybody.
And we also, other things we're looking for, and this is piggybacking on what Greg was just saying, we're looking for good stories. There's a lot of emphasis in the material that people send to us on sort of mechanical tricks. You know, here's here's this daily attack power that does 14 things, and you know, it doesn't actually interest us that much. But if the article has a really cool story hook that might expand a group's world in some way, and is married at the same time to an interesting mechanic, that's what we'd love to see. And when it comes to mechanics, we are much more interested in a power or a monster that has one or two strong hooks, not 14. Because particularly given the rhythm of play in a typical session, those 14 special diamonds that got put into that monster or power, they're really not going to get the spotlight in play. The thing that has that, you know, one or two really strong hooks, that's what's going to stand out. And it's also going to be easier for the person to use and probably be more fun to use.
And if I'm going to be put on a marketing hat for a second, if you're looking ahead at what we're putting out schedule-wise as far as the print products, or especially the encounter season, and it's a little hard to tie it in scheduling-wise, but for example, the Lost Crown of Neverwinter is the next encounter season. If you were pitching an article a couple of months ago, are there ways that you might tie it in to sort of that setting, or maybe after the season is over, material your players might want to continue with? It that also helps make an article pitch stand out.
That's a good point. If you're going to the product seminar, Mike's going to be talking about products for the first 6 months of 2012. And we only have a handful of articles ready for those months. So we'll be looking to fill our calendar. And if we're seeing articles that are tied to those, you're giving yourself a better edge.
Mm-hmm. On that same note, Greg, how far ahead are you, like, when you're placing your Dragon and Dungeon articles and knowing where they're going to come out, how far ahead are you looking? Like, you're looking, like, 3 months ahead? Like, we can cite this article in, but I can't do it for 2 more months?
3 months is how long it takes just to develop the art. So we're usually, we have right now Dragon articles all the way out till June next year, but some of those articles, we still have a lot of content to fill in each of those months. So while we might have 3 or 4 articles for March of next year, that only represents, you know, a fourth or a fifth of what we need to put into that month. And we'll be looking at pitches and inviting people to submit articles during our next submission window.
The one other thing I would say on the topic of what we're looking for is we're not looking for people to try to guess what we want. We want people to give us things that resonate with them. Like, if there's something that excites you, if there's something that your group really digs, you are much more likely to write something that's going to resonate with us than if you focus on, what are those Wizards of the Coast guys going to like? You know, what are D&D players going to like? Well, you're a D&D player. You have a D&D group. What do you like? And what does your group like? Because as I mentioned earlier in the presentation, the family of D&D players is extremely diverse. So it's likely that if your group digs it, there are other groups who are going to dig it. Not everyone is going to like it, but somebody is probably going to like it.
A couple examples of pitches we've recently invited authors to write are a different take on the Far Realm. A sort of...
I love that one.
Alien abductees, sort of... I can't remember the specifics of it, but that warlocks, for example, are abductees that have been taken to the Far Realm, touched by these otherworldly creatures and then placed back on the planet. And another thing that and we just thought that was a really interesting idea.
And it made us laugh.
Yeah. And another, more in terms of utility, another author pitched an article that was simply treasure tables, mundane treasure tables that are themed towards specific races and geographies. So you might have just a list of elven treasures, or treasures from Baal Tirath or Arcosia, that type of thing, that we said, that's something I could use in my own game, and we invited the author to write it as a result.
Kind of continuing
not many people. not many people have pitched Artificer articles to us, or if they have, they haven't been ones that had a strong hook. But in my presentation, you saw the very first thing on the list is an Artificer article.
And
yeah, I came in right after that.
Oh, you missed that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I gave a preview of content in the next 6 months. And, yeah, and it's funny you should ask. The very first thing on that list was it's an article on Artificers of Gond. So it's Forgotten Realms themed.
And that's a
So you'd also like to see support for the Dex-based part?
Well, yeah, because there one of the Paragon Paths
I just want to see Essentials Bard.
Now, I'm curious, you say that. I think I know what you mean, but when you say Essentials Bard, what do you mean by that? Because, and I say this because to the fan base, the word Essentials means many different things. So I'm curious what it means to you.
It means more fun. like the Bard as is, it's a great class, but there's not a lot of support after, you know, there's not a lot of extra stuff for the Bard, but it seems like there's specific powers, there's a few at-wills. I just want to see auras. You know, the Defender Aura, for example, replaced marking as, like, Defender Aura is awesome. Mm-hmm. Marking is cumbersome. The same thing with the Bards. You know, the Bard throws up an aura, now everybody within, you know, aura 2 regens 3 when you're near me, or you have a +1 to your attack or something like that. You know, songs that radiate out. Just things that I can turn on. I'm singing along and I'm going to throw a dagger at me.
Well, in November, I think you should take a look at Heroes of the Feywild.
All
right. It was almost like you were taking a look at the book.
A lot of what you previewed is coming out on the website is very thematically focused on the books that are coming out around that time. Except September, October, where you had a theme, but it seems like the rest of Wizards of the Coast has a very different theme, focused on Neverwinter, 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 Neverwinter. But none of your content is following that theme. I was curious how that decision came about.
Oh, the Neverwinter material is going on right now.
Well, right, but it continues on up through the fall, does it not?
So, with
maybe are you thinking of
the content on the website for Neverwinter is going?
Yes, that's because my list started with September,
right.
So Neverwinter stuff on
but
the
a
website
lot of
is happening right now.
Of the book.
We have an additional theme or two from Neverwinter on the website.
So yeah, we generally when we have one of those product pushes like Neverwinter or Feywild, we will release a few articles that month to support that, and there may be a trickle of similar articles afterward. But we still have an idea each month of a theme that we want, and we try to tie in a few articles so that really Dragon and Dungeon end up being sort of a mix of the articles related to whatever content is currently out, articles that relate to a month's theme, and then articles that are just stuff that we want to see or that have been unsolicited pitches that we've accepted.
I'm just an FR fan. I'd like to see more.
So you wait until next year.
Good. I had a second question, completely unrelated, as far as things I'd like to see. Some sort of optional system for crafting that hasn't... I mean, there's some little corner cases of doing some little crafting things, but nothing where I could be Brewer Battlehammer going back to FR and craft Aegis Fan, you know, or go through that process of building something from scratch.
In my campaign, I use skill challenges, at least extended skill challenges, to try to get that across.
I think when you talk about the Heroes of the Feywild book, I think that's the first book that has a multi-role class in it. Do you want to talk at all about what your thought was in designing that? And
that
nothing yet?
If that gets talked about, it'll be on Saturday at Mike's product overview. Now, we do have classes on the game that encompass multiple roles, but you're right that this is the first time where a single character will encompass multiple roles. I mean, since we have, like, the fighter umbrella class includes a striker version and a defender version. But yeah, this will be the first time you can flip back and forth.
I don't mean this as a complaint, complaint, but a common thing that I notice happen has been happening with some of these recent development stuff is a lot of kind of corner case magic is just kind of shoved into the wizard. Mm-hmm. So like you got the Necro Nethermancer, and then you got the Bladesinger, and all this stuff is kind of getting pushed into a class that traditionally has been the, you know, I cast spells and they fly off my hands. Where you've got these other classes that I think could still suit that those roles. So I just wonder, I mean, is that something that you've noticed is that you're hoping to get away from, or you know, do you have ways that you can maybe adapt that material to make it fit other classes? Because just putting it in Wizard seems like, A, for one, the Wizard already has this kind of huge breadth of options to begin with, mm-hmm. and B, these other classes, you know, putting Necro or Nethermancer into something more like a Warlock, for example, seems like it might, A, be thematic, but B, give those classes something else, you know, rather than being focused into kind of an A or B, gives them a couple of different ways that they can express themselves.
Anytime we have looked at bringing back some classic build, like the Necromancer, you know, which is School of Magic in previous editions, or in the Neverwinter campaign setting when we were talking about the Bladesinger, we always discuss, you know, is this going to, like in the case of the Bladesinger, is this going to be a sword mage? Is it going to be a hexblade? Is it going to be a wizard, since the Bladesinger was a wizard in previous editions?
Steals the sword mage stuff.
So we definitely consider all of these angles. And two of the things we have to look at is, A, what will this new class bring to the game? But more and more, we also look at what that is already in the game does this class need to draw on? And in the case of the Bladesinger, we ended up falling on the side of favoring what that class needed to draw on more than what that class was going to bring. If we were focusing on sort of giving something to the system from an abstract point of view, almost certainly it would have been a sword mage. But for us, it was more about, we need the Bladesinger to cast wizard spells. Because the story of the Bladesinger is that the Bladesinger is a wizard. And we wanted the Bladesinger, to be able to draw on the wizard spell list. Because again, fundamentally, the Bladesinger is a wizard who wields a sword. So we knew that it would raise some question marks over people's heads about why isn't this a sword mage? Or why not a hexblade? I mean, because arguments could be made for mechanically for making it a hexblade. But in the end, we fell on the side of story and also the mechanical consideration of, we want this guy to cast wizard spells.
There's this, strictly an R&D question. Skill powers, for example, are sort of where I'm bringing this from. Anybody who's trained in a particular skill can grab these skill powers. Have you ever thought of doing that, widening it to power sources? You just have a martial power set that are leveled out, and anybody with a martial power source could pull this in as a replacement for something from their class. So you could do something where, you know, maybe some kind of martial feat, throwing an axe, for example. Anybody could take this, it's maybe not as great as a specific for a class, but allows you to pull that flavor in. And it's a generic power that an entire group of classes could pull from.
Something we could consider. It is something we have effectively been doing since the beginning of the edition with the divine power source, with channel divinity powers.
Right.
They're kind of these are powers just for members of this power source.
We also have, along the lines of skill powers, an article coming out this month, and we'll have more coming out over the next few months, of racial utility powers that can be swapped like skill powers. So that's another opportunity for someone, although they're not going to necessarily be linked to a specific power source, to find ways to sort of diversify or emphasize certain aspects of their character.
And one reason why we haven't, that's not a direction that we've gone in strongly thus far, other than in a few sort of corner case ways, like the channel divinity system, is any class, if we've hit our targets correctly, should have in it the flavor of its power source. So in a way, they already all are drawing on some, you know, similar thematic material, you know, that you should always, in play, be able to tell the difference, at least thematically, between a divine spellcaster and an arcane spellcaster. Now, we know that many of the game effects will be identical. You know, that when you press through the screen of story, the cleric and the wizard both just did damage to a guy and pushed him. But in terms of the thematic qualities and the other game effects that are associated with those common elements, members of the same power source already, again, do have this sort of family quality to them. I mean, again, divine power source is a great example. Almost, actually, every member of that power source has the option of taking some power that at the very least gives people temporary hit points, if not heals them. And there's a far, far greater cluster of those sorts of effects in that power source than, say, the arcane power source, where you're much more likely to see a huge amount of control effects, even for people who are labeled as strikers. Whereas, you know, the martial power source is sort of the domain of pure damage. At the end of the day, every power source has game effects that exist in every other power source. I mean, just as every role includes elements of every other role. I mean, every character is a mini controller. Every character is a mini striker. As my wizard has proven many times, every character can even be a mini defender.
As you were talking about the Blade Singer momentarily, you mentioned how you knew that there would be some questions, mm-hmm. that, you know, some people thought it should go that way or whatever. And in the age of the internet, that happens a lot.
Right.
You guys design something and people are like, well, what the heck are they thinking? Mm-hmm. I wanted to sort of use that as an opportunity to advocate for transparency. Mm-hmm. And when those things came up, look for avenues to talk to the players and say, we understand there are concerns. And I know you try to do that here and there and whatever, but I mean, even if it's, you know, explain it and then let it go, because it's the internet, some people are always going to hate it, right? But just looking for opportunities.
There's a lot of love on the internet, too.
There is.
Actually, speaking to what just said.
But yeah, that's great feedback.
I love it when a book or an article includes note from the designer.
Yeah. And I think we try and use the design and development column for somewhat of that avenue, and it's tended to be the design side up front explaining what's coming down, but it's design and development, so there's no reason why we couldn't go back and do, you know, the postmortem on whatever and use that column to make those explanations.
For the Blade Singer, I can see somebody being like, what the heck were they thinking? And you gave a very reasonable and rational explanation that I think most people would say, oh, okay, I get it.
Even if they don't, I think we're fine just having that dialogue,
sure.
And that's something that we strive for.
We are constantly improving ways to add more conversations. Like, we've got the rule of three, which is, I would say, a small start, right? So we're looking for questions out there. We're talking to these guys. We're getting their answers, and we're getting them back to you. We can definitely do more, and we're looking to do more. We got some more live chats.
We just had a live chat on Neverwinter with the designer, Matt Cernat.
We're looking to have at least one of those a month, for example, where people can just come in and ask those questions and get answers. And we are looking at more ways where we can just get these guys in conversations with you, via Twitter, VR, wherever it is. So
Even if it's just adding that commenting field on the bottom of articles,
which
frankly was sort of terrifying for some people at first. What's going to happen here? But no, it's a great vehicle for continuing discussion once the article goes out.
Hey guys.
Hey.
this is kind of from my buddy Mike Shea, because I was playing in his long-term epic campaign. Have you guys considered, as far as on the development side, removing the critical effects that generate automatically? There was a change to Righteous Rage of Tempest, and I know you guys have heard of this before. However, the change didn't adequately fix what the catalyst of the problem was, and there's still a build that Mike will never let me play ever again, where it's an automatic hit, and the damage is already high enough that you don't need to worry about weapon damage. However, you're able to stack 8 separate effects on a single attack, effectively taking Empowered Orcus to a little piece of jello. Mm-hmm. Like, stun, daze, ongoing damage, knocked prone, pushed squares, 480 points of damage.
One use character in Living Grub Gnomes campaign series.
You should email me your build.
I'm serious because it's
a new game.
It's one little niche of mm-hmm. that causes a greater issue of causing Mike Shea to cry.
Let's keep doing that.
But the catalyst is it's an issue within the critical system where you basically expand it from being the 5 or 10% chance mm-hmm. to an auto. Yeah.
And one of the things that we're doing now is, in addition to releasing monthly errata, we are Jeremy's team is going to be doing system wide reviews of different elements of the game, and there are going to be things like that where. If we're going to deal with it, we want to deal with it systematically, not as part of the sort of case-by-case errata, but as part of a larger review.
I'll email you after one of the layer assaults that's coming up. So you can fix it prior to that.
If I could just address how I solved his problem.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any crits on anything but 20 anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what power, what feat, what item you get, you never crit on anything but 20. And that's all. Now my players cry instead of me.
And I think that's a fine solution. I mean, that the game has a dungeon master for a reason.
Yeah. Now, this is another great example of our balancing act. There are certain groups where it is all about the crit fishing, and the entire group, including the DM, glory in the abject destruction of whatever the foe is in that environment. To that group, that is just awesome that they just reduced Orcus to jelly. For many of us, that wouldn't be satisfying, mainly because it's not narratively satisfying. At least, I'm a very story-oriented DM, and so for me, it wouldn't be satisfying. It would not be satisfying storytelling for that to occur. But again, there are groups where that's what it's all about. Let's turn those guys into jelly, and as quickly as possible.
On that line, I think it would be interesting to see more assets that we could use in an open fashion. In other words, having a simple description of a small town, having some of the people in the town fleshed out. I don't need stats. I definitely don't need stats. I don't need it to be an adventure. I just need a really simple town setting. Or over here we might have a temple, and that temple setting, here's a temple, here's what's going on. Everything's normal. It's not an adventure day.
So what you really want are some vanilla backdrops, it sounds
mm-hmm.
like. We have an
yeah.
article series called Backdrops that where we present different towns and locations, but those are usually specifically...
And this is an opportunity for me to try to recruit all of you to be advocates online for story-focused articles. Because the thing is, we love doing stuff like that. It's what many of us as DMs want. The thing is, anytime we do it, we have a whole segment of our fan base who attack us viciously because we didn't include any game mechanics. So please try to be spokespeople for the story side of the game.
Yeah, that's just community all up. I would say our character optimizer type group is much more vocal than our fluff group, our guys who want the story. They're probably equally balanced, but they're just so much more vocal. So if you guys want to
put it in the forums and just have our own website.
No, wherever you're at. I'm not going to have to come on to our community and talk about it there, but wherever you're at, we check all sorts of places. Wherever you're at, just be the advocates of the story elements.
But I think of one possible good way to do that is like through online generators and things of that nature, where it's a tool that DMs can consult, and it gives you not necessarily mechanical elements, but a huge depth of story elements that they can.
I would just like to see some of the resources taken that are, you know, going to all this extreme for tactical maps and everything,
mm-hmm.
just to see a nice small town map. and here's the lake, and here's the thing over here, and Bob happens to sell a few magic items, and Mary or Gwen over in the...
It's a village of Hamlet before the Temple of Elemental.
Right.
Actually, Hamlet was a great, the free Hamlet reward for the book. It was like the best template of a sandbox ever. The fourth edition one was like even better than the first edition one, which was my first adventure idea, was Temple of Elemental. So I jumped off.
Hey, it turns out that Gary, he knew what he was doing.
The tricky thing with the story stuff, though, is if it's too tied to a particular campaign, then it makes it difficult. Like, I like Dark Sun stuff because I'm running a Dark Sun campaign. So every time I see a Dark Sun article, I incorporate it immediately into my campaign. Forgotten Realms stuff, I don't even open. You know, there might be some great stuff in there, but I'm not looking at it because that's not the campaign I'm running right now.
Whereas I'll use it twice.
Yeah, so having a generic... You know, generic town. This isn't set anywhere. Not even in Venture Vale. It's just a template. I like that idea. In general, I think you could use that for just about anything. And plot hooks too. You have plot hooks in all over the different places, but you know, just kind of a compilation of this can go along, and then all of a sudden you throw this in your campaign and switch it up. You know, Chris Perkins and his, you know, if you read his column, occasionally do that thing. And then they had to, you know, fight level or paragon level goblins or whatever.
I play through all that stuff every week.
The Monday group.
Yes.
Curse you guys.
One thing we are doing that is sort of along the lines that what you're looking for is a new article series called Tavern Profiles. The first one we're doing is this month, and it's actually tied to Neverwinter, but then we have another one planned in November that's just a tavern at a Fae crossing. And it's not tied to any specific location. And that one's a little corner case, but we'll be doing these other locations that we're kind of hoping that people can just drop into any town that they want when they need a tavern. Because we know taverns come into most people's games at some point, and you can't really have enough of them.
We're talking about the Spectrum of DM thing, too, again, where it's whereas you don't want to take something that's Forgotten Realms and reskin it a little bit to be Dark Sun. Some DMs love that stuff. I think that's maybe the ones that want to dive in deeper because they're looking for more and more content. But I think most people are probably looking for something that they can easily just drop in one place or another.
Yeah.
Bart mentioned generators. That's something that I like to see in general is either like random tables or something built into the companion that I can click a button and say, you know, okay, I want to see a list of items that are level 6 and level 8. Give me a random one. You know, nothing. Or monsters. Anything like that, just ways that I can take something and just start from a blank slate. It's like, I don't know what I need, but I need this, and just get a thing back.
It's also helpful because it's content that can live a little bit more permanently on the site as opposed to I got to start fishing through the archives and hopefully find something I'd like. You know, and again, I don't even know how this might work, but submission-wise, if that's something that we could request from you and say, hey, I've got a generator. Is this something that I could pitch, not to the magazines, but to the website itself?
Off that same thing, we were talking earlier about adventures of a specific level. The fourth edition scales very well. Mm-hmm. It's very simple, well, maybe not very simple, but you know, you have your monsters, be able to say, okay, this is an adventure from 1 to 10. Slide the scale, and it's going to print out what the correct level of monsters and the correct DCs and the skill challenges, and print out your adventure. I mean, ultimately, you're just going through and you're saying, okay, these are the different pieces that will scale when the level slider changes.
It does scale remarkably well. For sort of precise scaling, there are some hiccups, particularly in monsters,
right?
Because there are particular effects that we are fine loading into an epic monster that we would never load into a lower level monster that will not be represented by the numbers going up and down.
But I think you're right. We could be taking advantage. I mean, we have the compendium online. We've got our material is online.
Well, then the monster builder already does it. I mean, I can go in and scale the monsters. And I can go in and scale the DCs. It's just, it would be great if it just print this module at this level.
Mm-hmm. On that line? What is up with the Monster Builder? Was that a, I mean, it just came out in April
1st.
No comment.
We're going to have a little bit of information on that on Monday. In an actual three.
Oh, it's like on Monday at Gen Con?
Yeah, it's coming Monday.
But again, we're focused mostly on content, so we can't really speak to the tools.
Yeah, that's.
I just know that because I'm putting together the next
project. As I mentioned earlier, that is dealt with by another part of the company.
Right. How do you actually get feedback to those individuals?
We pass it on.
Well, and I mean, there are threads on the community that Trevor is responsible for watching.
So we have. County Morgan, six people whose job it is to constantly read feedback on our forums, other people's forums, blogs, Twitter, Facebook, everywhere, and report on it constantly. I do personally four reports a week just on the conversations, and that's just me. I'm not talking about the rest of the team. So
I guess what I'm talking about, though, is in 2011 with BDI and all of these pieces, there seems to be, within Wizards, a huge disconnect from creative and technical. And the technical people never come to Gen Con because they were afraid of getting stoned, I think. And they seem to be locked away in this little room, and everyone else around them, well, we'll give that feedback to them. And,
well, I don't want there to be an impression that they're a completely isolated sect of Wizards.
We work with them every day.
I think you're right, they're not here at Gen Con, but that doesn't mean that they're not fully integrated in Dungeons & Dragons and the brand.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And again, we bring all of the feedback. I mean, we
you must have understand, though, from our perspective, mm-hmm. we don't actually see.
Well, I mean, so that's not exactly true, right? So, Chris Champagne, and I hope from, well, I don't know if Chris Champagne was here, but I hope from the DDI team were here last Gen Con. D&D experience, we had a few members of the DDI team there talking, answering questions. We don't have anybody here right now, and that's not helping this particular issue, but we're not hiding them away. We do let them come out and talk to people about the tools and all that kind of stuff.
I feel like I'm back there working on this stuff right now.
I definitely get the point, and there's no argument against it. I see what you're saying.
We take it to heart.
Yeah, and that's something good for us to know when we're doing our planning for next Gen Con.
Because, again, we, like you guys, we play and DM this game too, and we use the tools.
So, just by raising hands, who would like a digital D&D seminar thing? It just covers anything digital. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I thought it was a no-brainer, just wanted to make sure.
Well, I think the thing is a lot of us, you know, that's where the future is. And I think if Wizards is going to succeed, it's got to embrace that, and it's never seemed like it's really embraced it.
And I think they're
PDFs.
Yes, now that Bill's gone, Bill said we were going to get PDFs once he had the piracy problem solved.
Yeah, and the internet has solved the piracy problem.
Yeah, that doesn't happen anymore.
It was 2 years ago when they first took off the PDFs, and he's like, we'll bring back the PDFs once we have this piracy problem solved. And it was, for those of us who are web developers, that's laughable. So,
I unfortunately don't have anything I can report right now, but sure, it is something we're definitely looking at.
But I would just, for your earlier point, I would like to say that addressing that perception of communication is important to us, and doing things like Powell wants dev diaries, just further communication coming from the digital side, opening it up to the community, mm-hmm. getting that feedback, that is important to us. So yeah, point taken.
Yeah, again, we hear you loud and clear. I mean, we hear you here, we hear you guys on the forums every week.
We also want the tools to be the best that they can be.
Yeah.
Most of the DMing that I've been doing recently has been, I do all the organized play for the game store for the Encounters program. Mm-hmm. And so I see a lot of people come into the store, don't know anything about D&D, it's a dad with the two kids, or I even had a mom with her four kids or whatever. And they go in and they get a DDI subscription, mm-hmm. right? Because what are they getting it for? Because they want the renown points for getting the character builder and generating the character or something like that, or just character creation, make it made easier. Well, then you get along with that, you know, the Dragon and the Dungeon Magazine subscription. But you know, that's, I don't know if they really use it. I don't know what your the feedback from players or just even people who start using it just use character builder and don't download any of the magazine content. But I'd really like to see
they come into an encounters program, go through that. I'd like to see it for those that do DMing. I bring them into they play, because the cycle I've seen is the player comes in, plays a while, and says, hey, I want to DM after a while. You know, they go one or two seasons, mm-hmm. and then they want to DM. They go in and DM, they do that for one or two seasons, and then they go away. And then they, you know, is there any kind of content that you have, like adventures or things to transition them? So, oh, you just DM'd this encounter season for the first time. You know, oh, you'd like to go higher than third level with that, take your buddies from school or whatever you're doing, you know, and take that. Is there really support to do that, like to continue that adventure? You know, because I really like to see that in the, you know,
That's something we've actually just done recently with the Ivar's Shadow mm-hmm. adventure, where it continues on from the encounter season.
Right.
Yeah,
and it's something I would love to see us do more of.
Yeah, we're planning to continue to develop adventures that allow people to continue the season. We also have the new program starting, which we'll talk more about in the organized play or playing in public seminar tomorrow, I think, which is Lair Assault, which is a much different program, but at least another program that offers people an option who are graduating from encounters and want something that's a little bit different, a little bit more challenging.
And to that point, do you have any more plans in the adventures to be, or like the Scales of War kind of thing, like let's take it from first level to the 30th level kind of thing, or...
That's a good question. We are going to be wrapping up the Chaos Scar series shortly, and if that's something that people are interested in, I would be eager to know, because with that series stopping, we'll be looking at other similar sort of adventures. Is that something that people want? I mean,
yeah.
I know we also have... I don't know how much I can spoil here, but I'm going to go for it. an Against the Giants series starting later this year, written by Chris Perkins.
I think you make an interesting point, though. We have a lot of material that's sort of, hey, become exposed to D&D through encounters.
Right.
And then we have a lot of material on the website and the print products that sort of has an assumption that you're fully versed in Dungeons & Dragons.
Right.
But that learning curve to get from one to the other, it can be improved upon, I think.
Because when they come into the store, they start playing, that you get the DDI subscription, you're getting this other magazine from it. They may not even look at it, or it's like, oh, yeah, whatever. You know, like my son, he started with that, you know, but he's not going to get those articles or anything like that, because it's not really geared towards him. It's geared towards the player who's going to min-max this or, you know, do whatever. Yeah, I've been playing D&D since the 70s, but, you know, it's... For the young people coming in, there needs to be more content here for them. Like, hey, new stuff.
Yeah, we do a very deep end, and we do a very shallow end.
Right.
And that middle ground tends to be sort of lost sometimes.
Yeah. I don't know if that's another magazine besides Dungeon or another magazine.
Oh, I come from, from the web perspective, it seems like something that we would want to address on the website. You know, you've been to encounters, okay, well now what's the next step? That should be a good resource. Mm-hmm. That gives you that track of what you can do, resources.
How do you go from encounters to the next step? How do you, because from a company perspective, you want to try to convert everybody or increase your market share of money that's out there available. And so how do you do that? How do you grow that industry?
I'm a new DM. How do I start my own campaign? How does that work?
So we have 5 minutes. So you have 5 minutes to any last bits that you would like to see either in a Dragon or Dungeon or in our physical product.
I'm not sure I understand. I'm not going to come up next, but what was the reasoning behind putting labels and like darkening the art on the back of the last set of tokens you put out? Is that actually, for my purposes, kind of eliminated some of the utility there? Because I like to play around with what those actually represent.
I'm sorry, which tokens?
The ones in the
monsters.
If you flip them over on the bloodied side, that's what you're talking about. Yeah. Their names are there. I actually have no idea how those names got there.
I assume it was a reaction to criticism that some of the monsters were difficult to identify, particularly NPCs, but I'm not sure where that specific decision came from.
Yeah.
Some marketing.
And then the man behind it.
you were talking about like getting people to, you know, develop tools to do what we'd like to see done. That's great. But I hear a lot from, you know, I've talked to people before, like, you know, it'd be really cool if we could design something like this. And some of these guys are developers. They don't know where to find the API. Mm-hmm. They don't know what their restrictions are as far as what they can and can't do. You know, the GSL is confusing, and they've heard the horror stories of people who put something out there and then the lawyer hammer comes down on them, and, you know, so they get scared off from doing it. So it's great. You know, yeah, there are people out there who want to do it, but I think they're intimidated by what kind of mess they're getting themselves in.
Sure. And I sort of threw that out there, not knowing what the realities are necessarily. I just think it might be interesting for us to pursue as far as soliciting content.
Yeah.
If that content has a digital component to it, what's possible for us, what's not.
Right. I'm with you. I'm just saying if that's what you want to have done, may I suggest that if you take this to the digital team, that you make it transparent, you make it so that people understand exactly what they need to do to make it happen, or what the limits are as far as, you know, here's what you, you know, if you're going to tie into the opinion, here's what you can do with it, here's what you can't let you do, you know, you can't store this information, you can't keep this, you can't reuse this, you know. Mm-hmm. That sort of back and forth would make it so much easier for people to say, okay, I can sit down with this, I can make my iPad app, I can make this stuff, because I know that once I publish it, you know, I'm not going to have to go through the mess of dealing with WASI law division.
Yeah.
And figuring out, okay, well, what do I actually need to change if I'm going to make this legal in the future?
Yeah, I suppose I was thinking more of, you know, generators on our site that we would purchase outright, things like that. Outside, well, I know that it sort of is a legal hurdle.
But again, that's good feedback for us.
Yeah, I noted it. Yeah. And the last question there.
Yeah, it's just wanted to go back to touching on, you said that you use the same tools that we do. How do you get the new things into your campaigns onto your character sheets before the things are published? And there's kind of backstory to that, because I think most people in this room probably want to add their own content to any of your products, and that's effectively impossible at this point.
Trevor, can you speak to that?
I'm just looking for other questions.
So, but it sounds like what you're asking for is the ability to put house rule in the character
or
builder.
Whatever.
Yeah.
That's still coming. I mean, it's actually it's one of the highest priorities for feature things in the character builder. It's also one of the most complicated ones. Is like you were saying, making you know, custom items, custom powers, custom whatever, right? It's definitely something they're looking at. It will be done. I just don't have a good solid answer on it.
And as far as to answer your question to me about, you know, how we use the tools in my home campaign that I DM, my players, even though a number of the people in the group either work at Wizards or have worked at Wizards, don't use anything until it's published. So in my home game, they are using the material when you guys can use it.
Yeah, in my home game as well, I have a number of non-Wizards employees who are just use the normal rules, as well as a number of Wizards employees who are still, I still have used the character builder. But I have a highly customized home game, so it's got some challenges, and a lot of that just is scribbling over your character sheet with notes, because like, they only have one healing surge in my game.
Yeah. And in my home game, I have a player who's never even seen the character builder. So again, it's a spectrum. And I think we have time for a last one. Right?
I just wanted to say thank you for changing the style for writing adventures, for the published adventures.
The format, yeah.
The new format.
Yeah.
Adventure format. Much better.
Just out of curiosity, for those who have seen the new adventure format, do you prefer it by raise of hand? Anybody like the old format better? Okay.
Well, thank you very much, everyone, for all of your questions, your comments, your criticisms, your suggestions. We value all of them. If you have things that you think of in the next 5 minutes or the next 2 weeks or the next 6 months, you can always send us your feedback at dndinsider@wizards.com. And that in that address, that's an N, not an ampersand. Have a great convention.
Thanks.